Well, our sermon this morning is from Matthew chapter 17, verse 24, to Matthew chapter 18, verse 14. So a long section. In fact, we're not even doing the whole section this morning. We're only doing half of a section. Remember, I've told you again and again and again, and I like to reiterate it because it's so important. In order to understand the book of Matthew, you have to understand a couple important things. Everything's about the kingdom. And number two, you have to take big chunks together to understand what the little chunks mean. I hope you're beginning to see that it's so typical for us to know little stories, and as you'll see this morning, know little stories that also might occur in Mark or Luke. And you think, oh, I know what it means in Mark or Luke, and you think, that's what it means in Matthew. You can't do that. The material has been selected according to theme and laid out in big chunks. And you have to follow the whole flow of that whole section to understand what's going on in it. Well, we have that here. This section's from 1724 to 1835, all the way through that. And it's about life in the kingdom, and to give it a broad title. But we're only going to cover half of it, and I'll repeat kind of like a preview as we go into next week's sermon. But today we'll look at 1724 to 1814, and I've titled this one, Don't Be a Scandal, right? You know what a scandal is? Scandals happen all the time in our news, don't they? You read about something. What a scandal. And it's even worse when the scandal is in the church, isn't it? When there's a scandal in the church, does that affect you? It sure does. Even if it's some, as I like to say, and some of you don't like me to say it anymore, I've been told, kook. Especially the kooks. They get themselves into scandals. Now, you'll see as we go through this why I've chosen that word in particular. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the half-shekel tax, this is a special temple tax. These aren't Romans. This isn't a Roman tax. This is a tax for the temple. They went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" He said, "Yes." So here's Peter answering for Jesus, even though he has no clue what's really going on. And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first. So he doesn't say, guess what the outside said? Jesus already knows what happened. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when Peter said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you'll find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." Interesting text. And you'll see I've highlighted a few parts in yellow. Parts in yellow are really the standout ideas that I want you to be able to really focus on here. Now, there's a lot of interpretations on this. Some people say, oh, this is about whether Christians pay tax or don't pay tax and blah, blah. You know, come on. Let's frame this as we're supposed to in terms of the kingdom and understanding we have now entered a new large section in the book. It has to do with Jesus' position in the kingdom. Why do you think he says kings of the earth? He uses the idea of kingdom of earth to illustrate who he is. And of course, he's talking about the temple. That should give us a clue as to, again, his identity as the Son of God. So he's really focusing on his position in the kingdom. Jesus can pay the tax, but he's not required to pay the tax. That's his whole point in the question and answer that he has with Peter. Do I need to pay the tax? No, because I'm the Son of God. I don't need to pay the tax. It doesn't apply to me. But not to give offense, we'll pay it anyway. That's what he's saying to the people, to Peter here. So he understands this. Jesus isn't required to pay the tax because he's the Son of God. So first we have the idea of his identity, but then he also brings the kingdom aspect to bear because of this particular illustration. Who do the kings of the earth tax? So he's foremost Christ here, and he wants you to see that. Those in the kingdom of God are the sons of God, and we're not required to pay the temple tax. First for Christ, but also for Peter. Jesus is extending this. In my kingdom, we don't have to pay the tax. There's no tax in Christianity to the temple. Jesus pays the tax But note that he doesn't pay it personally. He has the fish pay it for him. This story only occurs in Matthew. It's very unusual. And it's the only time you read anything about catching a fish with a hook. He didn't catch fish with hooks. You caught fish with nets. So it's a very unusual story in many, many regards. But Jesus pays the tax, but he doesn't pay it personally. Peter catches the fish. He finds a coin in there worth two people's worth of tax, and he pays it. It's sufficient for both Jesus and Peter. So neither of them are actually paying the tax, although they're paying the tax. But Jesus indicates why he pays the tax. And this is so important here that I've highlighted it for you. He pays this tax because he doesn't want to cause needless offense. Now, this word here, offense, is very important. We have this word throughout this whole text this morning, and the word is scandalon. Okay? A stumbling stone. Some of you are familiar with this word. It's a very important word in Christianity. You've heard it many times. Theologically, it's an important word. Jesus talks about himself. He quotes, he is the stumbling block prophesied in the Old Testament. The stumbling stone, the scandalon. That's what it is. To have a stone of offense or a stone that somebody will trip over. That's what this word is here. And Jesus doesn't want to give them a reason to be offended at him that isn't necessary. He's going to give them lots of reasons to be. They already want to kill him. But this isn't going to be the reason why. This wasn't the hill to die on, and he's not going to make an issue of it. But this word here, scandal, that we get the word scandal from, scandalon, the stumbling stone, very, very important. Now, what's happening in Jesus is he's being humble in paying the tax, in not wanting to cause an offense. Sometimes you give up your rights in order to not give an offense. So let's move on to the next section. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Again, this story occurs in many places in the gospel, but we have to fit it into the context in which it's reported here. And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." So we have humility here. Jesus is raising up the idea of humility. The humility he just showed in paying the tax, not giving an offense and being humble, he now honors humility and says this is what he wants in his kingdom. Mark and Luke say at this point the disciples were arguing amongst themselves about who was the greatest. Matthew leaves that out. It may have been precipitated by the previous chapter when only Peter, James, and John go up on the mountain with Jesus and the rest are left behind to fail at casting the demon out. Peter has in the past answered very positively and received the keys of the kingdom because of his knowledge, but he's also been rebuked. So there's all this, well, I'm better than you because of this and that. And, you know, and ultimately we have John being the disciple Jesus loved. There's this tension among them of who's the greatest. And Jesus says, we have to become like children to enter the kingdom. So entering the kingdom is about entering the fullness of it. There's a process, even for ourselves, in which we come into the kingdom. We come into it when we're saved and regenerated and all the processes that are involved at that time. But there's another ongoing humbling and ongoing place of faith for us as well, as the kingdom is more established in our own lives and families. So the disciples already have some aspects of the kingdom, but they don't fully have it. And we were talking about that last week in terms of the identity of Jesus. They could see, in the last few weeks, they could see he was the Messiah and the Christ, but not the kind they wanted. They didn't want one that died. In fact, the verses that I skipped between the two things really tied to last week's, that Jesus was prophesying that he would die and be raised again. And they weren't. They're beginning to grasp, okay, he's going to die, but they still don't get the raised again part. They're still having great difficulty in the identity of Jesus. When Jesus says here, the greatest is the one who is humbled. So when you look at the child here, you have to be careful. You don't just say, we have to be like children to come into the kingdom. Jesus is picking out one very specific aspect of the child in this text that he's saying we need to be like. He's not saying in every regard. He's not saying the model of childlike faith. He's not saying the model of innocence. Goodness knows he's not saying innocence. He's not talking about being simple-minded or simple in your understanding or putting aside all the things you don't understand. He's not talking about that. He's saying humility. Humility. Whoever humbles himself like the child. The humility aspect is what Jesus is focusing on here, because his disciples are arguing about being the greatest. So that makes us stop and have to think for a minute. How is the child humble? Because I've known a lot of children. And they all weren't humble. Well, in what way is the child humble? Think about, I don't know, I think back to when I went to school and I think about all the kids there, and there weren't very many humble ones. The kids weren't humble in their peer groups, but they were generally humble before the power and authorities. That's different, isn't it? See, a kid can try to raise himself above his peer, but it's really a whole nother matter to overwhelm the power and authority that adults have. They generally don't try to take that. Why? They don't stand a chance. They don't have the power to do it. The child is humbled by his lack of power. So how does that relate to the kingdom? Well, we're not supposed to seek to have power over one another. We've covered this many times. We're supposed to serve. We're supposed to have sacrificial love. The idea of power, that's how earthly kingdoms are established. That's how earthly kingdoms are obtained. But that's not how Christ's spiritual kingdom is obtained. In Christ's kingdom, the great are measured not by their commanding power, but by their humble service. And that's what he has in mind here. Having power and authority isn't even the problem. It's the abuse of it that's the problem. Not thinking that you deserve it is the problem. Think how many people that have power and authority, and they think they deserve it. We get into that position, and we think it belongs to us. There must always be a recognition of who the real king is. See, as soon as we forget who the real power and authority in the kingdom is, that's when we begin to exercise it and lord it over one another. Jesus actually has a whole parable about that, doesn't he? And it's the ongoing and important lesson in the Old Testament. Does the king recognize that he isn't really the king? Does he recognize that there sits one enthroned higher than him? Then Jesus warns about causing others to sin. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, but whoever causes one of these little ones to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and be drowned into the depth of the sea. Woe to the world for temptation to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. So there's this warning here about not causing others to sin. Now, the children in this passage, he's not talking about children. We have to follow the context. He's talking about those he was just referring to. He's talking about those who belong to Christ, whatever their age. Those who have entered the kingdom because of their humility, because of their humbleness. They're humble. They've humbled themselves like children. They've entered into the kingdom. And now how shall they be treated? So Jesus has two ideas here that are in parallel. The first is accepting believers because they're Christ. That's the first one. Whoever receives such a one in my name welcomes me. There's that first idea. And the other idea is the second part of causing them to sin. There's the believer and there's the causing them to sin. The causing them to sin is the antithesis to welcoming them. They're put in parallel, the reverse parallel. So here's the idea. You either welcome them or you cause them to sin. That's what's being done here in this particular text. So what does that mean? You're either welcoming them or you're causing them to sin. It means that when you reject a disciple of Christ, you don't welcome them because they bear the name. When you reject a disciple of Christ rather than welcoming him, you're causing them to sin, and you come under the judgment Christ refers to here. And this is very interesting, because typically we look at that and say, well, you just don't want to cause a believer to sin. Well, certainly you don't want to do that. But as you examine the entire context here, you begin to see that it's actually like what we like to focus on in Romans chapter 15, verse 7, where it says, welcome one another as God has welcomed you. You see, really the ideas that are being presented in this text are the exact same ideas there. That we have an obligation to welcome all those who bear the name of Christ because they're in the kingdom, and not despise them or reject them. It's the exact same idea. And if you do, you come under the judgment that Jesus is talking about. Now, why do I, you know, it's not talking about the world rejecting Christ's disciples. That goes without saying. This is talking about life in the kingdom. We must never reject those God has accepted. This is probably the number one flaw of the Christian church. We're divided by foolish things and therefore under the judgment of God because of it. It's better to die having a large millstone tied to your neck than to divide the church over things that you have added to the gospel. That's what this text is talking about if you follow the flow of the argument. He says, woe to the world because of stumbling blocks. Now you see I've underlined a few words here. Causes to sin, temptations, and temptations. Now in the Greek, that doesn't say temptations. In the Greek, that's the words scandalon, stumbling blocks. The very one we had Jesus talking about himself, I will not be a stumbling block to these people. He's saying, don't be stumbling blocks in the kingdom. Same word, emphasized in the text over and over and over again. These are not temptations or things that cause people to sin or causes one to sin. Not those words used in translation. Using stumbling blocks, using the right word there, reminds us of the idea that Jesus was prophesied to be the scandalon. He is the stumbling block. He's the ultimate divider, the stone that causes men to stumble. But we aren't supposed to be that. We are never to cause others in the church to stumble. We are not to divide the church. So what's the solution? Is what he gives in verses 8 and 9. And if your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. What's his solution? Remove from within you or from without you whatever causes you or yourself to stumble. That's the solution. Now, just so you know, this isn't hyperbole. Like people like to write this off. Well, Jesus is just speaking hyperbolically. he's using hyperbole. So he doesn't really mean do this. Yeah, he is. It's better to go through life without a hand than to go to hell. Do you think that's hyperbole? Do you think actually losing a hand in this life would be worse than hell? See, now when you think about the whole thing he's saying, you can see why it's not hyperbole. Hell's that bad. Now, if you're not going to hell because of what you do, then don't worry about amputations of your body parts. You can speak figuratively about them. I encourage that. If you plan on cutting any parts of your body off, please come see me. There are other solutions to the problem. I don't think you literally need to fulfill this, although some people in the history of the church did. I think you can solve the problems other ways. But to speak of it more figuratively, anything in you that is a problem that causes others to sin, that causes others to stumble, must be removed. That especially can be issues of pride rather than the humility that we're supposed to have. Pride is always behind divisions in the church over theology. Always. Why is that so? Because when I know more theology and I'm willing to divide the church over, it's because I'm smarter than you are. I'm wiser than you. I got it more figured out than you do. And it always starts with pride. And as I've told you for the last, I don't know how long, years, you don't really know everything you think you really know. There's a lot of things you think you know that if you're really humble about it, you say, you know what? I'm not 100% like live or die guaranteed on those things. There are bits and pieces that are we can be quite confident of. What is the gospel? Quite confident of that. There's a lot of other Christian theology I'm not so confident. Not confident enough to split churches over. But humility prevents a lot of the stumbling stones within the church, especially ones over theology, but it's certainly not limited to that. I think if people in churches were humble enough that they wouldn't cause us to stumble, causing the division in the church. So let's look at where Jesus is going with this. This section, this next particular one that I'm going to read for you, it really goes with what we've done this morning and what we'll do next week. It's like I said, one big passage. So what does he say next? The parable of the lost sheep. See that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I tell, see, Jesus is still talking about the children, the humble, those in his kingdom. See that you do not despise. Now he uses the exact words there that I've been telling you is what it means. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. You see, we think about the parable of the lost sheep when we read it in Luke. This isn't Luke, this is in Matthew. You think Jesus couldn't tell the same story more than once? Here, it's fit into a whole different context, a life in the kingdom. That what happens when you despise somebody, when you say, that's not the right way to think about God on an issue that you might be wrong about. What happens? What happens when Christians are rejected by the church? What happens when they're despised out of the church? Now, let me address the idea here. Angels, that talks about here, their angels see the face of the Father. Maybe it's their angels in heaven. Maybe there's an angel for one person. We don't know any of these things. That's pure conjecture. It's possible that Jesus is even saying that when they die, their angel, their soul, don't look at me like that, will stand before God. In other words, he's saying that they're truly saved. Now, why would that be a possible interpretation? Well, if you go to Acts chapter 12, 15, when Peter is miraculously released from prison, and he's standing at the door saying, Rhoda, let me in. What's really going on there? What are the disciples? It's only his angel. It's he's dead. It's only his angel. It's possible. I'm not saying that we become angels. Do not take that way. I'm just saying language is fluid enough that it can be used that way, but not meaning that we become angels. We do not become angels, just for absolute clarity. No matter how you want to interpret this, the end meaning is the same. The end meaning is these people are truly part of the kingdom. The angel of them stands before the Father. They're true children of God. But here the context speaks of God rejoicing over the believer that's returned to the flock. Not the person who's not saved. Not the person who's saved for the first time. Here he's talking about the believer who has been despised by the church, left the church, and is brought back into the flock. A remarkable passage. How is he returned? When the church accepts. And God the shepherd rejoices over the reunification of his flock. See, the stories that we read in the Gospels that we think we know so well, when we really begin to see the context and the flow and the meaning of the passage and we put it all together, sometimes they mean things that we didn't expect. Trust me, I didn't expect all this. It took me a lot of hours this week meditating on how these fit together. And then in my study, I began to see that things weren't like they were, like I anticipated. You got to look at the broader context. God places a high priority on humility because it functions as a preserver of the integrity of the church. Christ was humble enough to pay the temple tax, although he was not required to do it. Why? So he wouldn't give needless offense. See, this whole section flows together. We who are in the kingdom are not to cause needless offense over issues that are not essential. To share God's value system, we must understand how disturbed he is when we act scandalously. When we cause another person to stumble in the church, when we make a person in the flock of God leave because of things that aren't essential, that aren't true, breaks the heart of God. And he rejoices when they're returned. This whole section is about that, and we will continue it next week.